Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Greetings, genies across the fruited plains, and welcome to another edition of Extreme Genes, America's family history show. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And this week on the show, you know, it's always great to get these stories of research, but also the DNA tales, because it often involves finding living relatives. And we have another one of those stories this week, but who knew how many living relatives this person would find as a result? We're going to talk to John Vitale up in Buffalo, New York, about his experience and maybe what you could experience, or somebody you know who might need DNA to connect with living family. It's another great story. Plus, later in the show, she's an artist. She's a woman who discovered that she's related to Nathan Hale. Yes, I have but one life to give to my country. We'll hear more from Susan Hale from upstate New York coming up a little bit later on. But right now, let's check in with my good friend David Allen Lambert, the chief genealogist of the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org, in studio with me. To what do I owe the pleasure, David?
I am so honored to be here, and I don't have to talk into a telephone.
Yeah, it's very nice. It's good to see you.
It's really good to see you, too.
And you even combed your beard.
I did. You know, I grew it extra long for the occasion because I wanted to make sure I had that going on.
Yeah, I am absolutely astonished by how much family histoire news there is to talk about this week. I mean, just a lot of incredible stories. And let's start with the World War II veteran reunion that happened very serendipitously this past little while.
Two Utah gentlemen, both 88 years old, Dean Salt from Ogden and Alan Sperry from Provo, were on an honor flight back in September, and they went to Washington, D.C. Well, since they were from Utah, they put them next to each other in the ceremony. They got to talking, and they said they were both in the Philippines. Got to talk a little bit more. They were there in the same time in December of 44. And then he mentioned his name. The other person looked quite aghast and said, "You can't be the same person." And Dean Salt reached into his wallet and pulled out a photograph of the two of them from 70 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
That he had never taken out.
You know, he had that in his wallet the whole time?
The whole time. Obviously, multiple wallets, one would guess.
Yeah.
It's really touching to think that these guys were 18 years old over in the Philippines, lost touch for 70 years by a chance meeting, reunited again. It just warms your heart.
That's a great story.
Some of the things that we look at in the future, obviously we had October 21st, 2015, the Back to the Future. The French did this back in 1900 with postcard and painted views looking at the year 2000.
Wow.
Some of them are really interesting, flying machines and people dropping bombs from flying machines, which World War I would see that.
Right.
But they had a very interesting one that I think you might like. It shows a man shredding books, but connected by wires, headsets that the students are learning.
Wow.
Is this any different than what we're doing now when we put audiobooks out or we digitize things so people can use them through the headsets or through their computers? So maybe technology wasn't too far off.
It's a pretty good picture. In fact, we'll make sure we get that posted on extremegenes.com. You'll have to check that out. Plus all the other photos we're talking about.
Exactly. There's some really great stuff, but sometimes there's not good news in family histoire news. The New York Times archives had a pipe burst.
Oh, now, wait a minute. The archives are in the basement?
Yeah.
Oh.
And
really?
Water doesn't work really well with photographs.
No.
And microfilm and books. And any archival material doesn't float well. So they're having to revisit and figure out what to do with this recently damaged archive.
Oh, my goodness.
It was essentially their photo morgue. So I would imagine whatever they had down there for any number of years. And one would hope that they have a digital copy, but who's to say?
The New York Times. That is unbelievable.
Speaking of photographs, did you see that story about Billy the Kid? The photograph that was found?
No, I haven't heard about this one.
Oh, my goodness.
We've had our friend Ron Fox on the show many times talking about finding rare, valuable pictures. But what was this one?
Well, this gentleman, Henry McCarthy, went out and he found a photograph for $2 in a junk shop. This photograph captures Billy the Kid playing croquet.
Wow.
It could be worth millions.
Now, wasn't he killed at like 18 years old or something?
He was pretty young when he died. And yeah. I think it was the late 1870s, early 1880s. But this would be an amazing find. And I would imagine they're matching it up by photo identification, because I saw the picture and it does match one of that young gunslinger from long ago.
Facial recognition then.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Wow. And they're thinking it could be worth what?
Millions. to the right buyer, there is a price for everything.
Well, that's right. And, you know, for the expert who identifies it, there go the rewards.
And that brings me to my tech tip. Do you know that pile of photographs you have that your ancestor kept and they didn't put the names on them?
Oh.
Well, you're in luck if the 19th century photographer's hallmark is on there. Putting his name and the address that he operated, there's a key clue there. Based upon your research as a genie, go and look at city directories. See when that photographer was residing in New York or Philadelphia or Boston or Iowa and try to figure out when he operated that studio and does it fit into the age of the person in the photograph. So that's my tech tip, and maybe you'll find a $1 million photograph, or it's going to be worth $1 million when you figure out it's your great-great-grandmother.
All right, David, great stuff. A lot of great family histoire news this week. And thanks for coming in studio. It's good to see you, buddy.
I hope that I can come back and do it again real soon.
Okay, we'll see you soon. And coming up next, we're going to talk to a man from Buffalo, New York, who has been missing family his entire life, but he's found it now. Oh, has he found it? Wait till you hear his story. It's coming up on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And we are back. Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth. Always enjoy hearing your stories of discovery from the distant past or the not so distant past, as is the case with my guest right now from Buffalo, New York. John Vitale is on the line with me. How are you, John?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Scott.
Boy, what a journey you have been on. I mean, you were orphaned at 10 years old. Tell us a little about that background.
Yeah, it is an interesting story. I don't recall my father. I do remember a little bit about my mother. And at 10 years old, she died, unfortunately, because of cancer. And we went from my brother, who was a half-brother, and I went to our family in a suburb of Buffalo named Lockport for a while. And because we didn't have a lot of money, the family tried to put us up for a while and ultimately had to give us up. We went to an orphanage. And we went to the orphanage without any knowledge of my father and very little about my mother, with no family contact.
That sounds tough.
It was difficult. So I grew up, my brother and I, grew up for about 50 years or so, not knowing our family. And
Boy. Then
through a moment of serendipity, it turned out that a friend of ours was able to put the clues together on Thanksgiving Day and recognize that he knew who our family was.
Really? Now, what did he do?
He was a counselor, a family counselor that helped me and what turned out to be my first cousin through independent sessions that he had worked with her and she and I on. And ultimately, he was able to put together the dots and was able to tell us who our family was.
Oh, wow.
And I remember the call that I got because I spoke with what I now know is my first cousin, but I had forgotten much about her. That was my way of dealing with the death of my mother and lack of family, et cetera. I blocked out a lot of memories.
Yes.
And I remember a story that she told me that only she and I were in the room. And when she told me that story, I had chills going up and down my spine.
Because you were already familiar with the tale.
Yes, that's right.
Wow, and only you and your mom were in on that. So first of all, how long ago was this that you discovered your cousin and you put this part together?
Yeah, that was about 5 years ago.
Okay.
We made this acquaintance again with our family. And since then, we've been doing a series of discovery events, if you will. And found that we had, in fact, cousins here in the Western New York area, but also out in San Francisco, out in Phoenix, out in Oregon. And then we had a couple of reunions here in town where we had a chance for everybody to meet us and for us to meet the family.
That had to be quite an experience for somebody who had no family for so long.
Exactly right. My wife has 6 brothers and sisters, and we always referred to her as having a large family. Well, I've surpassed that many times over.
Now, you did this all with paper trails?
We did, yes. And to some extent, as we made contact with other cousins, they had information that led to other information.
Right, as the way it always is. That's why it's so important to network within families to do this stuff.
We had a wonderful experience just to round this out, Scott. We were able to determine my grandfather's and grandmother's hometown in Sicily. And my wife Bonnie and I took a trip there last year, this time, in fact, last year, and had a chance to visit about 60 cousins, about 40 of those in Sicily and about 20 of those in Milan. It was a wonderful experience.
Wow. So you've really been on the trail here for the last few years. Have you gotten into the DNA thing yet?
Well, in fact, I'm glad you asked that, because I've wondered, having found so much on my mother's side, I wondered about my father. I had absolutely no information about my father, and I did do DNA testing, and much to my surprise, I came up with a granddaughter, and the granddaughter was born when I was 12 years old.
Wow.
She wasn't a granddaughter. It turns out she is a half-sister, and she's here today.
She's here right now? Who have you got there?
I have Rhonda here.
Rhonda?
Hi.
How? Out of the blue.
Out of the blue.
And you're the grandchild that he had when he was 12.
God,
fantastic.
That's pretty talented at 12 to be able to have a grandchild.
That is unbelievable. So you got in touch with Rhonda, John. And Rhonda, what was that call like?
Well, it was an email that I didn't actually believe, because he said that he lived in this town that I live in, which is a suburb of Buffalo, very, very small town.
Okay.
I get this email that said, hi, I think it said, he didn't know the connection exactly.
Okay.
And I went to the website, and I didn't see him listed on there, so I didn't believe him. I thought he was some kind of crazy stalker guy. So I called 23andMe. So I called them up, that there's a guy, like, apparently lives, like, right around the block from me. And I'm not seeing him on here. Why am I not seeing him on here? And they told me that it doesn't update right away. But they sent me to where the genotype connections are, where you can see how much of certain genotypes are completely matched or half-matched or whatever.
Right.
And he pointed me through. He said, this guy is your half-brother. And I'm like, oh, I guess I should respond to him. So.
You might want to get to know him.
Yeah.
Wow. So this was when?
This was back in, May.
May?
The first note we saw was in May of this year.
May of this year. So you guys are just getting to know each other now. And you obviously are very close, because you're in the same room.
Yeah.
That is unbelievable. So this is on your father's side, John and Rhonda?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yes.
Okay. And so you got to find out then, John, from Rhonda about your dad.
Yes, that's exactly right. And also learned that we have 9 other half-brothers and sisters that I did not know about.
Whoa.
Had some limited information, right,
yeah.
Rhonda?
Now, did you know about them, Rhonda?
It is such a complicated, diverse story that goes back, I don't even know where even to start with the situation, but...
Are they full siblings to you or half?
Well, it turns out that I actually have at least 6 full-blooded siblings who would be John's half-siblings, but I also have some additional half-siblings that are not related to John.
Okay.
So altogether, I have 12.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's what DNA does.
I was adopted when I was an infant and was raised as an only child. Now I have at least 12 siblings.
But how has that been for you? Have you gotten together with all of them yet?
Not all of them, because not all of them want to communicate with us. I've reached out to 2 sisters that were adopted into the same family, and I know that they're my full-blooded sisters, John's half-sisters, but they have not responded to me.
That's too bad. But you've probably made some good contacts otherwise out of such a large pool.
We have. Yes, we have.
So have you had reunions with them as well?
Well, we had, let's see, how many people? About 30, 40 people here in Buffalo in August. And one group come from Texas. Somebody come in from California. And there's another half-sister that lives here in Buffalo. John's and I both half-sisters, so on the father's side. One came in from New York City. She's a full-blooded sister of mine, a half of John's. And so, yeah, this has been a really interesting journey.
Yeah, it really is when you get into this. And I would imagine you've probably found some cousins as well.
The 23andMe lists 933 cousins of mine.
Now, wait a minute. 923, but I mean, how many close ones? First, second?
Well, there's a lot that, not a lot of first cousins, but there are a lot of third or more distant.
Right, third, which is typical of the DNA test. That's amazing.
I have to tell you, Scott, that I'm overwhelmed just with brothers and sisters at the moment.
How has it changed your life, John?
Oh, it's been a wonderful experience. Both the reunions on the part of my mother's side of the family as well as on my father's side, it's been nothing but pure joy meeting many people that I know now that I'm related to. And I lament a little bit that I didn't have the opportunity to grow up with them, but I'm thrilled to continue to live with them now from this point forward.
Well, I bet. How often do you two get together?
You know, we probably are talking once a week and face-to-face maybe once a month, I think.
Oh, that's awesome.
We're planning a family Skype call, which would be brothers, sisters, as well as first cousins, coming up soon. And we're going to use Skype as a way to do that.
Well, that's a great way to go. I do that with my own grandkids all the time. And you ought to get them out to a Bills game or something.
Oh, no, we would want to kill them.
Right now, the Bills and the Sabres, the two teams in town, are both on losing streaks. So.
Oh, maybe not. Maybe you don't want to do that at all. So what's been the downside of this? Has there been any real disappointment with it?
Only to me that I've identified these two sisters by name and address and everything, and I've reached out to them, and they don't want to know, or they don't, I don't know.
Yes. Now, have they not responded, Rhonda, or did they just tell you they're not interested in knowing you?
They haven't responded. I made contact through, I actually wrote them a letter. I found their addresses last Christmas, and I sent them letters which were not returned back to me, so I know that they were delivered. They never responded to that. And then through Facebook, my daughter connected with one of these women's stepdaughter who was very excited and wanted to connect us. And she said she'd try. And I guess she was having dinner with her stepmom that day. And I never heard back from her.
Well, maybe it's kind of like your initial response was to John. It's like, who is this person?
Yeah. Well, it didn't take me that long to connect, though, with John.
Well, it sounds like you're pretty good friends.
Yeah,
we are.
It's been great.
Absolutely.
Well, that's exciting stuff, you guys. Congratulations on the find. Another great victory. And what's the next phase for you guys? You're doing a lot of work. Are you writing a book about the family? Are you putting together all the trees? What's happening?
Well, we've already put together the trees, and there are three of them right now just to contain the family that we know of at the moment. And yes, we are, in fact, writing a book because I think it's a compelling story on both the mother's side, the father's side, Rhonda and one of her half-sisters coming in from Germany. There's many, many twists and turns.
Isn't that fun? And you know, you can self-publish now, so it makes it really easy to do, even if you're just making the book for your own family.
Exactly. And that would be the intent.
Well, John and Rhonda, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story. And congratulations and best of luck.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Hey, have you ever wondered how the discovery of family history can influence and inspire people in their lives? Well, you got to hear the story of Susan Hale coming up next from upstate New York on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, the radio root sleuth. And it is fascinating to me the way family history can influence a person's life and the direction they take and how they feel about who they are, their self-identity. I think this is certainly the case with my next guest, Susan Hale. She's an artist from near Albany, New York. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you doing?
Doing great. I heard about your research and how you kind of got into finding out about your ancestry. And the name Hale is kind of a big one in this country. Edward Everett Hale is your direct ancestor, is that right, from Boston?
Yes, he's my great-great-grandfather.
What was some of his story for people unfamiliar with it?
Basically, he was this minister in Boston, First Church of Boston, for like 30 years. After being a minister in Boston, he was the chaplain of the U.S. Senate. One person asked him, Dr. Hale, do you pray for the senators? And he goes, no, I look at the senators and I pray for the country. And I always thought that was pretty funny. I didn't really know a whole lot about him, but just by doing this show in Boston, it made me want to find out more about him. So just recently, I found out that he was an abolitionist and that he did quite a bit in helping the Afro-Americans get back on their feet, getting educated. He was very concerned and believed that everybody should have the same education. So he did quite a bit for that.
You learned about that when?
Well, let's see. My uncle from Maine, he had written a booklet for our family with everyone's names in it. And so we've had this book in our family for a long time, and I just saw all the names.
So it's something that kind of stuck in your mind from way back when?
Yeah. Growing up in school, you learned about Nathan Hale, and I always knew that was my great-great-uncle. And so I guess I sort of grew up knowing for a long time.
That you had a special family root in this country.
Well, I was very proud of him.
Well, I bet you were. Who wouldn't be? Now, let's talk about Nathan Hale for just a moment. Of course, everybody knows him as the spy that was caught in New York, sent by Washington to find out what was happening in Manhattan after the British had taken over during the Revolution. He was caught. He was hung. And his last words, "I only regret that I have but one life to give to my country." And there's a statue to him, I'm sure, in many places, actually. When did you find out about that? And how has that influenced your life?
About 10 years ago, I was listening to this Green Day song on YouTube called When September Ends. And it's basically about a guy who goes to war. He signs up to fight, and it was like right after 9/11. And so this was very much in Americans' minds about like fighting for our country. And the video, When September Ends, was very moving to me. And it made me feel like maybe that's how it was for Nathan Hale.
Yes. Well, he was a young man. He was, only 21 years old? Something like that.
And that's exactly the video portrays a young fellow and his girlfriend, how it affected her and how you lose people that go to serve our country. And I guess I just felt very strongly about that.
And it suddenly touched your heart a little bit more. Nathan became a little more real to you, yes?
Yeah. And so then after I had this vision of how, you know, it might have been for him, then I started wanting to read more books about him. And so I got several books from eBay and a collection of about 20 of them. And I can sort of see how it might have been for him. And so I wrote it down in a screenplay format.
Now, have you actually gone out trying to market the screenplay?
No, but it's funny. When I was at the event last week in Boston at the New England Historic Genealogical Society, at a dinner there, they were celebrating Nathaniel Philbrook's work. And his latest book that he's written was Into the Sea. And Ron Howard is making a movie of his book right now.
Yes.
So afterwards, I spoke with him and I said, "How did you get your book to him?" And he goes, "Well, you know, it's a long process." And I guess probably his agent submitted it to them.
Sure.
So, I mean, I hope maybe someday somebody will take a look at my screenplay.
Now, you have an artist in your background as well, I understand.
Yes. When I was at the National Arts Club in New York City, I was standing in the middle of this room. And all these, like, old paintings were all around the walls and everything. And it was just, like, this one painting, like, just, like, drew me to it. And I just thought, what a beautiful painting. And I really wanted to know, out of all of them, I wanted to know who had done that painting. So I walked over towards it. As I got closer, I saw on the brass plaque, Philip Leslie Hale. I'd seen his name in our family booklet. And I just thought, oh, wow. And I was just like, the style of painting was much like mine, like very impressionistic. What's really weird is that I'd never seen any of his work in my life. I didn't know anything about him. It was a very moving experience, and I wanted to find out more about him. So I found out that he was friends with Monet and painted with him in Giverny. And so this was a really exciting experience for myself.
Well, as an artist, that had to be that you would actually connect with your relative like that. Now, he was a brother to one of your ancestors, I assume. But still, I mean, the fact that he paints the same way you do, you can kind of see that family connection right there in just the way he did his art.
Right. It's true.
So have you found that these discoveries, Nathan Hale and his life and Edward Everett Hale, and now this Philip Hale, the artist, how long has this been going on now, your research, and how has this affected what you actually do in your creations?
I guess it just inspires me to keep going. And I really love doing art shows and concerts. I've always known that's what I've wanted to do, and I've been doing it for many years, and it's just like what I like to do. To have an art show at the Metropolitan Museum. Another uncle, Robert Beverly Hale, was curator there for 30 years for the American Wing of Paintings. And so it just, you know, I want to meet the bar of the level where they were. And so this past show in Boston was very exciting to me to reconnect with where the family came from.
It sounds to me like your family was kind of disconnected from all this amazing history until only fairly recent times when you kind of rediscovered it. Is that true?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. My great-great-grandfather, Edward Everett Hale Sr., then his son, Edward Jr., was born in Boston, and he came to New York in 1895. And he was an English professor at Union College in Schenectady, New York, which is where my grandfather grew up on the campus there in Schenectady. My grandfather wanted to go out west and get a farm. So he got a farm in Wyoming, and that's where my father grew up during the Depression. Then when my dad was 18, he wanted to come back east to go to school at Union. He rode a motorcycle across the country to go to school there. And that's where he met my mother, and so raised five kids. And he never was very interested in all this family stuff. You know, he could care less. You know, so what?
So you kind of felt isolated then. You didn't really know any of the extended history or maybe even many other relatives.
Exactly. I felt it was disconnected, and I have always wanted to reconnect. And I feel through many years I am getting reconnected with my family.
Well, it sounds like family history has really impacted you in a major way.
I'm very proud of them.
Well, Susan Hale, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your history. It sounds like this has really had an impact on you, and good luck with your art.
My website.
Yes, let's talk about that. I wanted to send people there. It's SusanBHale.com, and you can see her amazing artwork.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Susan, for coming on. And on the way next, our good friend Tom Perry, the Preservation Authority from TMCPlace.com, returns. He's going to actually forego some of his own business to teach you how to preserve some of your own audio at home. A little alphabet soup lesson coming up for you on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Oh, are we really going there?
We are really going
alphabet
there.
Alphabet soup. Hey, it's Fisher here, and we are back. Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority, and you're right. I mean, it's time for a little edumacation.
Exactly.
About this whole alphabet soup thing. And this is important stuff, because if you're looking to a lot of do-it-yourself projects involving digital items, well, this is where we've got to start. And certainly all the things you were telling me off air, I don't have any clue about half those things, Tom. So educate me.
Okay, you know, it's really crazy. And pull out some paper and a pen or a pencil. If you're driving, just ignore this segment until you get home and download it off iTunes or something. Because there's a lot of stuff in here. And we're starting to get a lot more emails from people that really want to do this stuff themselves, and that's what it's all about. If everybody came to us to have us do all their transfers, we physically couldn't do it. It's impossible. So I'm happy that more people are taking it on, their own responsibility, doing their own things, teaching other people how to do things. Just make sure that the people you're talking to are giving you the right education, that the people that are teaching you what you're trying to learn really know their stuff. Because there's a lot of people, unfortunately, out there that are trying to do their best. And I don't think they have any bad intentions, but they don't know what they're talking about, and they cause you problems. Just like in the old days when people would develop film, they wouldn't do Kodak because they could get it done at the corner grocery store cheaper, not realizing that Kodak says, hey, after you process so many feet of film, you need to throw away your chemicals and start over. Where mom and pa were sitting there going, hey, this film still looks fine. We can go through 50% more and save ourselves some money. However, 20 years down the road, your film fades and the colors go away.
Oh, that's miserable. All right, where do we start?
Okay, let's start with QuickTime. QuickTime was actually developed by Sony and Apple, and it's a great program. It's probably the most universal program you have.
Yes.
QuickTime, you can use it on your iPhones, you can use it on a lot of Androids, you can use it on computers, you can use it on just about anything. They're really easy ways to port a good-sized, good-quality video without hogging down your internet line. So QuickTime is probably the best way to go. If you're ever going to do something, you don't know what to put it in, go to QuickTime, because most sources you upload to, YouTube, all these kind of places, will take QuickTime as well as other places. A lot of people that are PC users don't really understand QuickTime, because QuickTime originally was only available from Apple, but it's totally available for anybody that has a PC as well. And another thing tied to QuickTime that's important is iTunes. People hear iTunes and think, oh, that's Apple. I can't do iTunes on my PC. Totally incorrect. iTunes is 100% compatible with PCs, and it's a great program. We have people all the time that come to us and say, hey, I've got these CDs, and I need to put them in an MP3 so I can send them off to different people, and I want to pay you to do it. Well, you know, I'm happy to take your money. However, this is something that is so easy to do at home. Even if you have virtually zero computer skills, this is something you can figure out. All you need to do is pop your CD into your computer, make sure you've already downloaded iTunes, and iTunes will usually come up and say, hey, what do you want me to do with this CD? And say, I want to import it into iTunes. It's totally free, no charge. charge. It'll import everything as an MP3, so now you have a great MP3 that you can email to people, you can put on your website, any place you want to do it, it's easy to access. Anybody can play an MP3. Now, we have people that are just the opposite. If you have some MP3s that somebody in your family has sent you of, you know, Aunt Margaret's funeral or different things like this, and you want to be able to put these in a normal CD to play in your CD player in your car, you're going on a long trip, and you want to listen to some old family histories that are only available to you on MP3s, you go to one of the drop-down menus on iTunes after you've loaded all these into iTunes, and there's a thing that says Create CD. And so that will go and turn it into what we call an AIFF file, which will make it a playable CD that should play in your car for a long road trip. That's a great way to not only preserve your family history, but let all the family know about. Instead of playing, you know, Disney movies in your car, whatever DVDs, play some old funerals, play different things just to get to know people.
Because funerals excite everybody.
They do. You know, that's funny that you mentioned that. We do a lot of funeral transfers, especially from the old reel-to-reels. And some of them are actually hilarious. It's based on your culture. Some people have a party when it's a funeral. Other people like a wake. Other people, it's just this sad time. But the good thing about it is you learn about them. Even people in your own family that you grew up knowing, maybe even your grandmother, you listen to her funeral, you're going, wow, I didn't know that about grandma. I didn't know she did that when she was little.
And so, Tom, you've been filling us in on a little bit of stuff to start with. We didn't get very far, but you've got a lot more.
Oh, yeah, there's tons of stuff. We'll, you know, fill this segment and probably into next week also. So we kind of talked a little bit about QuickTime, which is a great video way to store. We've talked a little bit about MP3s, explaining MP3s and AIFFs to you. MP3s are a digital format that's more for like using on your iPhone, your iPods, emailing. AIFF is more of a CD that you'll be playing in your car and your CD player for those that still have CD players. Now, one thing that's interesting, let me throw it in right here, which a lot of people don't understand. In most DVD and Blu-ray players, you can play a CD in them. Where people say, oh, I've got this CD, I don't have a CD player. Well, pop it in your DVD player or your Blu-ray player. Of course, the TV is going to be blank. It'll be either black or blue, depending on how you have a screensaver. However, you can listen to your CDs that way, and it's usually a great way to listen to them because most people with the big TVs have great sound systems hooked to them.
Sure. Could be all through the house.
Oh, absolutely. And one thing that people have said to us is, hey, I've got this old CD from that I had transferred from a reel-to-reel, and I put it in my DVD player, and the audio only comes out of one channel. That's because back in the day, it was mono. You could choose between mono and stereo, where nowadays, everything's stereo, super stereo, Dolby, all this kind of stuff.
Or two-track mono.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And if that really bothers you, you can usually run down to Radio Shack or any kind of electronics store and get what's called a Y connector. And what you would do, you'd take your RCA cable, which you'd plug into the bottom part of the Y, which now gives you two cables pulling out. You'd put one in the right and one in the left. So it's basically just splitting the signal. So you're still hearing the exact same thing, but it's in the right speaker and the left speaker, so it doesn't kind of throw you off.
What a nice, cheap solution that is.
Exactly. It's just like when one of the batteries dies in my left hearing aid, everything's on the right side.
Yes. That's a problem.
That can't be a problem. So that's one way you can get away from that. Now, the next letter in alphabet soup, which a lot of people get confused, what's the difference between an MP3 and an MP4? An MP3, as we've discussed, is audio. MP4 is video. So what an MP3 is to audio, an MP4 is to video. Now, that doesn't mean it's only video. It also carries the audio as well. So an MP4 is a nice compression format that really, really makes things really tiny. So when you're wanting to send a video of somebody, put it on YouTube or send it to a relative, it's a good way to send it because it's so small, but yeah, the quality is really, really good. In fact, several years ago, they were talking about not making movie DVDs anymore. Everything was going to be on a USB drive. So you plug a USB drive into your TV, and a lot of the new TVs do have the USB drives. So if you have MP4s, most of the new widescreen televisions will have a USB port. You can plug that right in, and you can play right from your USB drive, which is incredible video and amazing sound.
Wow.
So that's a real good way to do it. People that are trying to transfer their own videos have bought different kind of boxes that do the transfers, and they say, hey, I've got this real high-end Blu-ray that I want to transfer to something else, and the HDMI only has an out port. Why doesn't it have an in port? Well, the problem with that is it's all copyright issues. They're trying to keep all of us honest. So what they've done is they built things into it where you can't actually use an HDMI out into a recorder in, because you could take any DVD and make a copy of it and it'd be pure and beautiful. So basically what we're going to do next week is talk a little bit more about this alphabet soup, get into some more different kind of connections on the back of your TVs, your VCRs, and find out why X and Y sometimes don't work together.
Well, and hopefully we'll save you a little money in the process so you can do these things on your own.
Exactly. You can do it yourself, save some money.
All right, great stuff. Thanks, Tom. We'll see you again next week.
We'll be here.
Hey, that wraps up our show for this week. Thanks once again to John Vitale and his half-sister, Rhonda, who only just met a few months ago due to DNA testing. In fact, they've got a lot more siblings that they've come across as a result of that. And to Susan Hale talking about her amazing ancestry and how it's affected her life, including her great-great-great-great-great uncle, Nathan Hale. Catch the podcast if you missed it. Talk to you next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.